Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You can talk about film with a philosopher's zeal, or measure them all by box office appeal. But for once in your life,
be real!
Welcome, one and all, to a movie reviewing, reappraising, and director interviewing podcast on the Playlist Podcast Network. This is Be Real. My name is Chance Solomon Pfeiffer.
And I'm Noah Ballard.
Noah Ballard, you and I are setting up an interview today. I got the chance to talk to Mark Webber about some of his acting career, and more notably, the new film that he's made, Place of No Words. He's on the interesting string of what he calls reality cinema, which is where he sort of takes some part of his life and extrapolates it fictionally, often playing himself, often casting real people in his own life. So we're going to talk about Place of No Words, and we got an interview with Mark coming up. What do you know Mark Webber from?
I know him as the maybe son, spoiler, from Broken Flowers.
The Jim Jarmusch movie with Bill Murray?
Yeah, and then of course Scott Pilgrim versus the World, he's a bit part in.
Yeah, I knew him from Green Room, which we talk about. We talk about Scott Pilgrim coming up. We talk about Jim Jarmusch a bit. But yeah, he's got this interesting run of semi-autobiographical, truly DIY films. And The Place of No Words is the latest. I would call it sort of like a reversed semi-improvisatory Princess Bride. It's like Mark and his son Bodhi are kind of in a fantasy realm of Bodhi's with trolls and witches and hints of mystical creatures, but it's all sort of, you see in a kind of non-narrative way how it's reflected in this other fictionalized life that Bodhi and Mark and their mother and wife, respectively, Teresa Palmer, are living in.
I think we were texting about it earlier, and you described it well as Where the Wild Things Are-esque. I think it's almost like Terrence Malick by way of Spike Jones, but also like very concerned with this particular artist, Mark Webber's nuclear family, and the idea of what, and it seems like the idea of loss and losing a parent is quite meaningful for Mr. Webber, because he's kind of addressed that in two of his movies.
I watched Flesh and Blood too, which is currently on Prime. Place of No Words drops on VOD on the 23rd of October, but it's interesting how he can juggle this idea across different styles too. In Flesh and Blood, he plays a version of himself that kind of never got out of the Philadelphia street life, and you see him get out of prison and then come and live with his mom and his younger brother, and that sort of has a docu-realistic kind of Deborah Granick feel to it. And as you said, this new one is Malickian. A couple things that I liked about it are when you see Mark and his son in the fantasy realm, they're like pretty gnarly looking. Like I really thought it was going to be a sort of, you know, the Starks venturing out into the wild wilderness and like, keep your head up, son, or I'm going to get cut in half.
It kind of has Valhalla Rising vibes.
That's what I was trying to, I couldn't remember the name of that movie. It's Refn, right?
It's Refn, yeah. Well, when I watched the opening scene of the movie and then thought about the title, and I was like, oh, is it another like Vikings who don't speak to each other for 90 minutes movie?
That's what I thought. And so there is a sort of pleasant surprise where, you know, Mark in a coat that looks like it's from two grizzly bears and weighs 45 pounds is like coming up this cliff face with his son. And he's like, oh, you got a runny nose there, buddy? It's not the kind of parenting you expect to see in that aesthetic. And really, it is a movie, and this is what Mark and I spend the most of our time talking about parenting, and in some ways, like, some real pressing questions about, like, when to introduce a child to the idea of death.
Absolutely. I was definitely moved. I think if you're in the mood to be moved a little bit, and you're in the mood to, like, put your cell phone down and, like, get into some of these bigger questions of, you know, especially if you either have, like, a kid on the way or a young kid in your life, you know, and when that moment comes where you have to have some of these fantasy breaking, fantasy ending, coming of age moments with them. There were at least 2 points where I became the big wet eye emoji found on your keyboard.
Should we turn this over to 2 microphone having emojis and go to the conversation with Mark Weber?
I'm giving you the thumbs up emoji.
Once upon a time, words began to vanish from the language of children. They disappeared so quietly.
Please stay here with me.
Enter the wood with care, my love. It deals in things that are missing and things that are hidden.
I don't know if there ever really is a right time. There's a wrong time, it's never.
You believe in magic, don't you? Am
I
dreaming?
I see the whole world in your eyes.
What's happening?
Mark.
Hey!
How you doing?
Good, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for hopping on today. I appreciate it, man.
Yeah, no, totally. Thanks for having me.
Maybe we could just start with something random in the new movie. There's a moment that took me aback in which a character in the fantasy realm starts reciting the lyrics to a Bright Eyes song. Mm-hmm. How did that make it in?
You know, Bright Eyes, his music it's been really influential to me. You know, I remember first listening to one of his first albums when I was, you know, my early 20s. Mm-hmm. And it just, I don't know, just formed a time for me and living in New York. And the interesting thing is that in the End of Love, the first film that I made with my 2-year-old son, Isaac, well, when he was 2 at the time, had a clip of Bright Eyes music in there.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, I was just listening to that song one day and the lyrics just had an interesting relevancy to the film, you know,
yeah,
and to some of the themes of the movie. And I thought, you know, let's go for it.
I suppose that makes sense. I mean, I think about that song, like, literally, and it seems like sort of the reverse side of a night out, but your movie is all about the reverse side of a fantasy land.
Yeah, totally.
That makes sense. So maybe we could kind of walk backward into the notion of reality cinema, actually, because I think when you bring it up around people who make films or write films or talk about them, the special part is the reality part. It's what makes it so different from other movies. But when I was thinking about it on, like, a personal level, I had to imagine it might still be the pretending that is the special part. I mean, almost nobody gets to set foot in an alternate reality of their own life. And you've now done it 4 times. What's that like for you?
It's deeply fulfilling. And I think about it so much, you know, the older I get, and I just feel so grateful that I'm able to fully express myself as an artist and do it with people that I love. So it feels like even more of a gift. And that's something that I've strived for. You know, it's been part of my intention is to try to carve a different path and way for myself as an independent filmmaker, kind of distance myself from the pack a bit. I get so much out of it. And then, of course, you know, I'm going to get another thing out of it 10 years from now. in another 10 years from now. Mm-hmm. And that's the beautiful thing about, I think, filmmaking and making films. You know, if they can hang around or be talked about and revisited throughout different periods of time, they take on different meanings. And that excites me, you know.
I was thinking about that actually with, to take a side road for a second, the 10 year of Scott Pilgrim just happened. And that really felt like obviously people have always loved that movie, but it kind of felt like a coronation of like, this is going to be one of the movies for another 30 or 40 years. That's just widely beloved. Did you feel a burst of energy around that?
So much. It was amazing. And it was, you know, and to have a little bit of that vision, knowing that that's what was going to be the case for the film back then, you know,
really, you could tell,
you know, we definitely all still know to this day, mm-hmm. how special of a group of people it was that was brought together. And Edgar is just such a tremendous filmmaker. We could tell, you know, this movie was doing a particular thing in a way that hadn't really been seen before. And, you know, sometimes people have to catch up, you know, and I like that. I've been a part of, I guess, a bunch of quote unquote, like cult classic films in my life. And I love it. You know, it's almost like you watch other films explode and get a lot of attention and then fade away into obscurity or just get buried by the sheer amount of other works coming out. And so it's really nice to be a part of something that is getting rediscovered and celebrated 10 years after the fact and seeing like, okay, yeah, this has got legs. This is going to be around for a while.
You'll probably be doing something at 20 and probably at 30. That'll be fine.
Yeah, totally. And that's really awesome. You know, things that can stand the test of time. I think, you know, any filmmaker, any actor, any person would be lying if they didn't say that that's something that you hope for to happen with things that you're a part of, you know?
Right. Mark, I've heard you say that you're, in terms of your filmmaking taste, that at a certain point you just became obsessed with realism and authenticity in terms of your own work. Was there a particular light bulb moment for you where you found that that was the case?
I think it was like, I think a lot of things happening, a bit of a reaction to the process of the way films are typically made and the structure of it. There's a tendency of this baked in kind of hierarchical way that I never loved, you know, about like above the line and below the line and certain terminology that like I was waking up to how, okay, this has been functioning and serving making films one way and it doesn't really help filmmaking so much. Hmm. You know, I could see how on films that I was a part of just as an actor, how the typical way of making a film and the process and the labels were holding back making something interesting and were in fact making things more difficult. And so that was part of it as well too. I was like, okay, I want to, when I start making films as a director, I want to create the ultimate environment, not just for me as a performer, but for the people that I bring in to make this thing. I really want this to be a celebration and a joint experiment.
Speaking of maybe hierarchical breakdown, one of the things I wanted to ask you about this new movie is that as you're watching it, it really feels like it is authored in a major way by Bodhi. I mean, you're getting these extrapolations of, you know, what he's doing with his toys and his instruments in the real world and how that's transitioning, but also just like the rhythms of the movie is you being like, so where do you want to go? But it's like over there, like five or six different times.
Yeah.
Was there like a sort of, why did that feel like the right question to ask when you're making the movie? Where do you want to go, son?
Because it's how I think every parent lives their life in so many ways. And for me, having children, it was waking up to the fact, okay, this isn't just about me anymore. In fact, it's about you. And how can I be the best version of myself to serve you as a little person, to have a better life, a meaningful life, a life that's maybe a bit more free of some of the fear or doubts that I had when I was younger. And I wanted to really honor how a child's mind works and is free.
The way that you grew up, unhoused for a part of your youth, what kind of doubts did you have that was important for you to, or is important for you to try to dispel with your kids?
When you grow up in a capitalist, materialistic world, a consumer-based world, where you're constantly being overtly and subvertly conditioned by stuff to tell you that, like, you need more stuff. If you get more stuff, that's going to make you better. That's going to make you feel happier, be it money or fame or items. When I experienced the type of poverty that I experienced and not having these things, especially at an age, you know, 10 years old, where it's very much about, at least then it was as a kid, the things that you have, you know, the sneakers that you're wearing, the video game. Do you have Nintendo yet? Do you not? So my self-esteem took a big hit. With my children, self-love and self-esteem are so important, and helping create moments of distinction for them of, like, what is an esteemable act, what is how to feel whole. And it's funny because, you know, as kids, you're people pleasing on some level. You want your parents to be happy with you. You want your friends. You want the world. And you are experiencing this loss of innocence over time.
So Bodhi was 3 when you made this, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's, like, some really tough conversations about death that you hear being had. And maybe the hardest part of that actually is kind of, you can hear in Bodhi's voice sort of like the breakdown between the metaphor of, you'll be in my heart is not enough. That's not what I want. I can't live in the metaphor of this. What was it like to have those conversations for the movie? Was there a lot of explaining that went into it before and after?
So much. And that, I'm glad you brought up that particular sequence, because that was real. It was a real conversation.
Mm.
And that happened about 7 months after we had been done filming.
Oh, really?
That was a real moment between Bodhi and I laying in bed. And something in particular kind of triggered him. And he got vulnerable. And he was having this vulnerable moment. And he opened up about not wanting me to die.
Hmm.
You know? And also not wanting mom to die and his brothers or his sisters. And just having a real moment. And I hit record on my phone, on my voice memo on my phone, because being in the midst of the editing process of the film and just, like, meditating and marinating and swimming in this sea of all these big, tough questions, and in the midst of making the movie, and then, oh, wow, here we are in real life. All this effort into making this piece of art with my film, with my son, now here's the real life moment. And so I captured that. And then I used that as a backdrop throughout this, you know, particular sequence in the film. And
do you feel like the film jogged that loose for him? No way to know.
I think a bit of both. I think it's been interesting going on these journeys with now both of my children, is that there's a bit of magic timing. There's a bit of me knowing as a parent, okay, this making this film with Bodhi at this age and talking about what we're going to do and what this film is about is going to resonate with him. And it's just, it's coinciding with where he really is at as a little guy. Bodhi has not seen the film all the way through, right? Because first and foremost, I talk about this a lot. Like, I never stop being a dad. I'm a dad first, and protecting him emotionally, exposing him to challenging things and then talking about it in a safe way is what this film was. Mm-hmm. But that being said, now it exists as it's this piece that's is pretty emotionally, it can get intense and a bit complicated. And for him, I don't think it would have necessarily been appropriate to watch it, you know, straight away.
Yeah.
And so now he kind of is at that age, and he'll be 7 in February. And I have this new kind of built-in experience where we get to celebrate this thing and watch it together, but then also have a really great conversation about it and what it brings up within him, you know?
That in itself is a really interesting notion, that like based on what he could see when he was in it, he was ready to be in it, but not ready to see the thing.
Not ready to see it, because it works. It works different. And it's funny, my 12-year-old son, Isaac, he's 12 now. We made The End of Love when he was 2. He still hasn't watched The End of Love. He's now at the age where he totally can watch it. Mm-hmm. And he looks at just the trailer and it's too emotional for him, you know? And I got a bunch of sensitive little guys.
Yeah.
And I'm very similar, and I get it. I relate. I'm like, I totally get it. But Bodhi right now is like totally pissed off and wants to watch The Place of No Words. He's ready for it. Yeah. Isaac still can't handle it, but Bodhi's like, Dad, I can see it.
Yeah. Stop calling me a sensitive little guy. I'm ready to go.
I'm ready to go, man. I know.
This makes me wonder, having seen Flesh and Blood this morning, has your little brother stayed interested in filmmaking?
Yeah, I'm so, man, thanks for watching the movie this morning. That's so cool. Like,
of course.
My brother is something else, man. He is like, he is a writer. He's written a couple plays now. He has a very unique,
cool
voice. Quite talented. He has used what his disability, his being on the spectrum, he's embraced it and he's used it in a way that is very exciting to me. He's also a singer in a band.
Oh, wow. Awesome.
And he's a filmmaker. He's an artist. He's totally an artist. And I'm learning stuff from him now, which is so cool. You know, he'll send me music and stuff. And I'm like, what, who is this? Like,
that's cool. What?
He's going to contribute culturally to this world in some significant way. I feel it totally.
Speaking of contributing culturally, I want to know what lessons you took away from working with Jim Jarmusch when you were in Broken Flowers, and then he produced your debut, right? Or was one of the producers on it?
He did. You know, Jim took on executive producer credit. It was the first time he had done it outside of his own work. Anything
really?
He
never had before?
No. And wow. He did it for Explicit Ills at the time. And that was like such a like, and he did it because he wanted to protect me as an artist. And he didn't want anyone who was giving money to make the film to want to try and take away Final Cut or anything. And so here's a tremendous cosign, right? Yeah. And someone who was willing to step in and say, no, Mark, let Mark do his thing, that you couldn't really argue with, because here's someone who has just made the films that he wants to make the way that he wants to make them. And so it's set such a beautiful precedent for me and really protected me as a filmmaker. And that is the single largest thing that I've taken away from working with him, is how to respectfully assemble a group of people who believe in your vision and want to support you, and just do the things that you want to do the way that you want to do them, while being kind and thoughtful. You don't have to be an asshole. you know.
A lot of visionaries aren't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know.
Do you have time for one green room question before I let you go?
Of course. Yeah, totally.
So that was made up kind of in my neck of the woods. It's one of the most intense theatrical experiences I've ever had. But then I was watching a making of featurette last night.
Yeah.
And the set also looked super intense. And it was just like Patrick Stewart being like, I'm standing in the rain. I'm not used to standing in the rain, but I like it. What was that? What was the temperature of that production like for you?
I didn't really know so much about certain areas that those neck of the woods and the little pockets of white supremacy that exist.
There. We've learned a lot more about the pockets in the last 5 years, for sure.
We have, right? Yeah. And so, you know, then I had I did a little deep dive into that, and that was concerning. And I think also because we knew we had some really awful, hard stuff to tackle. So I think everyone was like just really mindful of being extra supportive of one another. So that felt really great. We all knew we were making something really special. Jeremy is quite the visionary. And his experience as a DP as well, and also with makeup, we all felt like we were in very great hands, that we were going to achieve that intensity.
But in a safe way.
But in a safe way, you know? And yeah, I look at that movie and it's so, so bittersweet, you know? Anton was just such a beautiful man. He was such a great person. And we spent so much time on that film together. And my friend Alia Shawkat and my friend Eric Edelstein. It's really, I was actually just looking back at photos recently of behind the scenes stuff, and me and Anton have some pretty, pretty gnarly behind the scene photos where I'm in the full prosthetic of like my head blown off and we're doing like poses together. They're like,
oh, no.
So inappropriate, but like amazing. And I look at them now and it's, of course, you know, I see it and I see a friend that I lost in a tragic way to. Yeah. Soon, who had so much more to contribute to the world. So it's extra special, that film. It's riled some people up, and it's really people really love it for what we achieved in that. And I feel so lucky, man.
What's the right age for the kids to see Green Room? 50?
Yo, seriously. Like, never go.
Yeah, right.
But it's so funny. My guys, like, anything horror or thriller related, like, if like a preview comes on, like I keep throwing Isaac under the bus because he's the funniest one, though.
Yeah.
But like a preview for like Annabelle or something came on, like anything puppets or things. And he's like, turn it off, Dad. I'm like, yeah, no. They don't even, like, Isaac doesn't even want to watch Dark Knight with me, you know? So I think that they'll discover Green Room way later on. In life.
Oh, if it's an experience they want to have. Well, Mark, such a pleasure to talk to you, man. Thanks for doing this.
Totally.
Congrats on just doing exactly what it seems like you want to do.
Thanks, bro. I really appreciate it, man. Thanks for taking the time.
All right, cool. Well, good luck with the movie and hope to see you down the road sometime.
Thanks, man. Okay.
Be well.
Bye, you too.
Where do we go when we die?
Where do you think we go?
Well, many thanks to Mark for the conversation. You can find his movie, Place of No Words, on VOD. And like I said, you can see his prior movie on Amazon Prime, if that's your jam. You can also watch his first movie, Explicit Ills, on Amazon Prime as well, Prime Video. Noah, what's our next category? You want to tell the people?
Yes. This week, we're in for the Halloween holiday. We're doing the Halloween movies of Tim Curry. A very Tim Curry Halloween, including, but not limited to, Rocky Horror Picture Show, the It two-part TV movie, Legend.
That's right.
And then we may also talk Clue as well, we may refresh on that. We did that a couple years ago.
That we did. Rocky Horror is on Hulu. Stephen King's It from 1990 is available to rent on Prime. Clue, you said, is where?
Free on Prime.
Nice. And Legend is rentable. So we wish you all a very happy Halloween.
Ooh.
And we're going to talk to you again. Oh, my, sir. Those are the kind of truly homespun sound effects you can expect to hear next week. Please join us then.
I'm telling you, we got to bring back the sound effects guy.
I know that it is freezing, but I think we have to walk. Keep waving at the taxis, they keep turning their lights off.